Hey everyone, this is Noor, and you're listening to the Radical Contemporary Podcast. We're dedicating this month to some of the most influential athletes in the region, talking to us about their fitness journey, cultivating an active lifestyle, and what keeps them motivated. This episode is powered by Nike. And now I'll leave you with my co-host, Yasmin Inewi.
Hey everyone, this is Yasmin, and in this month's bonus episode, I speak to Egyptian tennis legend and star Ismail El-Shafai, who also happens to be my grandfather. Ismail is the only Egyptian who has reached top 20 in the global ATP rankings. During the 60s, he won Wimbledon Junior, which paved the way to his tennis career. He was famous for beating superstar Bjorn Borg during the quarterfinals at Wimbledon and touring with some of the biggest tennis players. Years later, he retired his racket and moved back to Egypt full-time, where he managed to become the exclusive distributor for Nike and Dunlop. Ismail and I talk about the importance of mentorship, touring the world as a tennis star, sacrificing a social life to become a champion, and finally, never giving up on your dream. This has been one of the most inspiring conversations I've had, and I'm excited to share Ismail's story with you all. Okay, on to my conversation with Ismail.
It's such an honor to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you.
So the one thing that really inspired me to have this conversation was with you is not only that you were a tennis star back then, but also when I was watching the Netflix documentary, I don't know if you watched it or not, the movie of McEnroe and Borg, you know that you were in it, right?
Yes, definitely, I know.
So then I thought, why not have you tell your story? And we're going to start right now. So tell us a little bit about your tennis career and how it started and what was the biggest moments for you back then.
Well, I come from a tennis family. My father was a tennis player. He was the champion of Egypt in the 40s and the 50s. And I guess he started teaching me tennis when I was very, very little, starting at maybe 8 or 9 years old. He got a racket and made it small for me. I was a little short when I was young. So I couldn't reach the net. The net was even higher than myself. Anyway, I started playing and I showed good potential. So he took me very seriously and he pushed me into the game until I started winning matches, started winning juniors under 12 and under 14 here in Egypt. And when I was 15 years old, I won actually event 16 and under, 18 and under, and the men's event. So I showed really good potential from age of 15. I started traveling abroad. I played in international tournaments. I won junior Wimbledon in 1964. And I won the Orange Bowl, which is the second biggest junior tournament in the world, in 1965. I played on the tour as an amateur for 2 or 3 years, until I finished my university in Cairo University. I graduated with a degree in economics. And then I started in 1969 playing full-time tennis. And in 1970, I turned pro. Okay. With an American company called World Championship Tennis, okay, owned by an oil tycoon from Texas named of Lamar Hunt.
Okay, and was great-grandpa Adli with you on all the tours?
Well, no, he did not travel with me. At the beginning, I traveled with an Egyptian team, two other players, Mabrouk Muhammad Ali and Shahid Murad. We traveled for a couple of years together, summertime, when we were on holiday from school. And then I guess I took a leap more than them, being able to play in higher events that they would be. So I started traveling on my own. In 1970, I turned pro, and I kept on playing until 1983. I decided to retire, okay, to hang the racket on the wall.
Getting match.
Yes, I actually graduated quite young. I was only 20 when I graduated from Cairo University. And that gave me more chance and more time really to start going on the tour. Only 20 years old, that's quite young. And I did well in 1968 and 69 as an amateur. Yeah. And I was offered a pro contract in 1970 with World Championship Tennis.
How was it being a star Egyptian tennis player? You were all over the media in the 70s. And not just that, but also playing some of the biggest stars in tennis back then, like Borg and Stan Smith and all these people. How was that?
Well, it's you become one of them. You start traveling, and I was actually everybody else around me. They were traveling as 4 or 5 Americans together, 4 or 5 Australians together, and I was the one and only Egyptian traveling. So I had to meld down with everybody, and they were all good friends of mine. We would play, and tennis was a little different at the time than it is right now. Mm-hmm. There was not much money in it, so we could not have an entourage around us. We could not have a trainer with us. We could not have a physiotherapist with us. We could not have people around us like it is now.
Yeah.
All the stars now have a team attached to them.
And a manager.
And a manager and everything. But at our time, there was not enough money on the tour to sustain something like that. So everybody was more or less on his own. We used to practice together, play matches against each other, and then go and have dinner together. So we were very good friends. It was fun.
And travel the world.
And travel the world, yes.
And when did you want to know that you wanted to become a tennis player and go pro? Why did you decide to do that?
Well, as I said, I showed potential and I excelled in tennis as a sport more than any other sport. Mm-hmm. And I felt more comfortable playing tennis than swimming or playing soccer or doing like that. I was better in an individual sport.
Mm-hmm.
There is a difference between soccer, which is a team sport, and tennis, an individual sport.
Yeah.
And I had the drive to try and reach a high standard in tennis.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked very hard since I was very young. I would work alone. I would go and run 10 kilometers a day on my own. I didn't need somebody to push me. I could push myself, and this is very important.
So tell us a little bit about the sacrifices you have to make in order to reach that top 20 level.
Well, it's you have to set your priorities according to the goals that you want to achieve. And one of my priorities, actually at the time, the priority was to become a tennis champion. Mm-hmm. And for that, I had to set my time differently than my friends. I have to study, and I have to train, and I have to train so many hours every day. So my outings were very limited. I could only go out once a week because the other 6 days I have to study and I have to train. So it becomes a bit different style of life.
What was your most memorable match to date? And what did you like most about it?
Well, there are many matches that I would remember, but probably the one that stands out is when I played against Borg at Wimbledon.
Mm-hmm.
And Borg was just coming up to Wimbledon, winning Rome Championship and Garros, which is the first Grand Slam tournament, and coming in as the favorite to win Wimbledon as well.
Yeah.
And I played him in the fourth round of Wimbledon, and I played a fantastic match. I beat him very easily in 3 sets.
That was the match they showed in the Netflix.
Yes. That was an exceptional match to win, especially in the Grand Slam, because Grand Slam, you have the focus of the media.
Yeah.
More than any other tournament. So it was a big thing, but... I have wins over every other player that was on the tour. Rod Laver, who was the undisputed number one, we played 7 times. I actually won 4 and he won 3.
Mm-hmm.
But he was still the number one.
And are the rankings different back then to how they are now, or is it still the same?
Probably it has changed a bit. The point system has changed a bit. There are more tournaments now. Probably the field in tennis now is much stronger in depth than it was before. Now, if we say the undisputed number one, Rod Laver, is he better than Federer or Nadal? It's difficult to decide. It's a different atmosphere, different era. Yeah. Rod Laver was playing with a wooden racket. Federer and Nadal are playing with a graphite racket. Big difference. A graphite racket increases the power of the ball by at least 30%. So it's a bit of a different game. But let's say Rod Laver at that era was undisputed number one. Federer and Nadal are undisputed best two players in the modern era.
Yeah. I think the one thing that hasn't changed is that Wimbledon still makes everyone wear white.
Yes.
Until this day. Mm-hmm. what was your favorite court to play on?
Of course, the four Grand Slams are the four outstanding tournaments that anybody would want to play in it and do well, because then you get the media, the focus of the media on you, and it makes it easier for you to get more sponsorship contracts and things like that.
Do you ever feel like you could have continued more with your tennis career, or you could have reached higher?
Probably I could have reached higher if I was if looking back at the time, if I had somebody with me who could have become my mentor and was traveling with me, because I was traveling on my own. I was the only Egyptian traveling.
Yeah.
So that means I'm traveling on my own. I tagged along with a New Zealander who was my doubles partner. His name is Brian Fairley.
Yeah.
And we were traveling together. He was a loner, I was a loner. So we sort of tagged along together.
Is that how you got your nickname, Izzy? How did you get that?
It's from the tour. I don't know where it started. I guess for some of the players, it started with Ismail. A lot of people say Ishi, Ishmael. So it started with Ishi, and then it went to Izzy. Yeah. And probably Izzy was easier for everybody to pronounce.
Yeah, it probably is.
Yes.
okay, so we were talking a little bit before recording this episode about what it means to become a star versus becoming a superstar. Can you elaborate on that?
A superstar is the player that stands out. He's a ticket seller. Everybody wants to watch him. Everybody wants to watch Federer, Nadal, Djokovic. You have other players like Medvedev now, and Thiem and Zverev. They're stars. But still, when you say Federer or Nadal, everybody's going to rush to the court to watch them play.
Yeah.
So these are the superstars. Yeah. The others are stars. They're extremely good players as well. Mm-hmm. And they can be the superstars. But the name Federer or Nadal or Djokovic carries more weight. Yes. And that's why they're called superstars.
Yes. And is there any advice you would like to share to someone who wants to become an athlete, or whether it's a tennis player or not, what is the one thing they should always focus on?
Well, focus, you have to give it the time to practice, to do as much as you can, to listen to your coach, to listen to his advice, to listen to what he's telling you to do. And you just have to work hard and keep working hard. And no matter what happens, you don't give up. You just keep working hard.
Yeah, never give up.
Never give up.
You actually mentioned not having a mentor. Do you think having a mentor does help?
It does, definitely. That's why now these days you would find somebody that is specialized in mental toughness would be traveling with Federer or Nadal, a psychologist that would be traveling with him, of course, a physical fitness trainer, and so on. So he's got a full team that would back him, because you go out and you play, you come out, you're very tired, you need somebody to talk to think of what happened in the match, to think of what went wrong in the match. Especially you learn more when you lose a match than when you win a match.
Yeah.
So you need somebody that you can discuss with him what was the weakness of that day.
Yeah. And was that something you used to do after your matches? Did you always focus on what you could have done better?
I would focus, but I would focus on my own.
Yeah.
I did not have somebody to focus with.
And back then there was probably no recordings and stuff like that.
No.
Like nowadays.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So moving on to sponsors and brands. Obviously back then I'm not sure if there was sponsorships like there are now. But do you think that this made a difference in the game? Bringing on, you know, how like Serena and Federer have such a huge collaboration with Nike, and how a lot of brands want to sponsor these big stars. What do you think attracts these brands? And was it like that back then?
Well, back then there was not much money in it, and the media and the television coverage was not as much as it is right now. Mm-hmm. So it's all related to what we call TV ratings.
Okay.
The TV ratings in tennis kept going up and up and up, and that's why some changes happened in tennis. For instance, we used to play with a white ball.
Yeah.
But because of color television,
we changed
the color of the ball to suit television more, because you could see the yellow ball on TV better than the white ball.
Yeah.
This is the first change. The second change is we used to play in white clothing.
Mm-hmm.
We changed to color clothing. And you should be, at the time, we were not allowed to play in the same color.
Wow.
So it gives you a better identification on TV. Mm-hmm. If a guy is wearing red and the other one is wearing yellow.
Wow.
So it is better identification on TV.
Okay.
So a lot of changes that happen. We had the prime time of television usually is 2 hours.
Yeah.
Matches could go on and on for 3, 4, 5 hours because the set could go up to 25, 23.
Yeah.
And that's why they introduced the tie break to shorten the match to suit the prime time of TV.
So that's why the tie break was invented.
Yes, that's why the tie break was invented. And now once the TV rating for the sports of tennis went up high, that means more sponsorship for the tournament and for the players.
Okay. And that's when brands started getting involved.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, so also, how were you able to manage your family life and your tennis pro life? Because there was a time when you already had a family.
Lots of tennis players traveled with their wives, and if they have children, probably they would be young children at the time. So my wife traveled with me a lot, and was the first child. She traveled a lot with us.
My mom.
Yeah, which is your mom.
Your biggest fan.
Yes. She traveled with us a lot. Actually, she started the first time on the tour when she was about 5 months old. We left to Europe, stayed for a couple of months in Europe, and then went to the States for about 3 or 4 months. So she left here at, she was 4 months old and came back at 10 months old. She literally grew up on the tennis court. So then traveling was getting a bit more difficult.
Yeah, when they started growing
up more. Yes.
And is that why you decided to retire your racket?
No, I retired. I was 35 years old when I retired, and I started having injury in my back, and it was very difficult to keep on with that injury. And so I decided that was enough anyway. 35 is about the right age to retire. Federer is 38, but he's an exceptional person.
And we're in a different time, honestly.
Yeah.
I do believe that. The technology of things made it
easier definitely
the physical body. Okay, so once you retired, you moved back to Egypt full time.
Yes.
And you decided to open a company, which included getting Nike into Egypt, correct?
Well, I started the company on a small scale while I was still playing.
Okay.
And I had the agency for Dunlop.
Yeah.
Which was a very strong company at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now Dunlop is not as strong in tennis racket as it used to be.
Yeah.
So we started. I started that company was limited, only the one brand I had, which is Nike, and then I started playing less and less and taking care of more the business, and the business grew. Was more brands coming on board until I was able to sign a contract with Nike to become their exclusive distributor in Egypt.
And how long ago was that?
Nike was in signed the contract in 1999.
Okay.
So that's almost 20 years now.
Yeah, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And did you ever feel like you wanted to expand the company more, or do you feel like...
Well, the Nike is a huge brand, and it's a very strong brand.
Yeah.
You have to give it a lot of attention, a lot of time.
Yeah.
We have a side business on the fashion side. We have two Spanish companies,
mm-hmm.
Corte Fiel and Springfield, which is casual clothing and casual shoes and things like that. So it's just next to Nike.
Yeah.
But Nike is 75% of our work.
Yes. And...
And we still have Dunlop, by the way. We still run Dunlop as well.
Dunlop is still here.
It's still here. Well, Dunlop is very strong with the tennis balls.
Yeah.
Still very strong. It's very strong in squash with the squash balls. It's almost has world exclusivity in squash balls.
Mm-hmm.
It has is strong in squash rackets, but it's sort of gone weaker a bit on tennis racket. I got Dunlop because I was a Dunlop player myself. I played with the Dunlop racket, so... I know the product. I know the people behind the product in England, and the same was Nike. I know footwear. I know sports footwear. I know it's not just tennis, but I need a good tennis shoe and I need a good running shoe. And Nike is the best. Is the number one company, and anybody that is able to get Nike on board, then he.
It's a huge opportunity.
Yeah.
And what do you think is the best tennis shoe right now?
It's a difficult question. I mean, let's say the leading brands all have very good shoes.
Okay.
Nike will stand out as the best selling shoe.
Mm-hmm.
There is a difference between the best shoe and the best selling shoe. Like Adidas have a shoe that was made in the 70s and it still runs until today. It's the Stan Smith shoe. And it's been the first it came out on the market in the 70s.
Yeah.
But it was such a good seller that it stayed. And that's it. But everything, the fashion evolves. So the clothing fashion for sports evolves as well. So you had, for instance, the tennis shorts were kind of short.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Agassi started playing, if you remember in many years ago, mm-hmm. he started the trend of having more like a Bermuda short,
okay.
a longer short.
Yeah.
And it became a fashion. Whereas in my time, nobody would wear such a short.
Yeah, that's crazy how time has changed. Okay, what is the one thing you would have told your younger self looking back at your career all these years ago?
Well, looking back, I think I could have done a bit better in tennis if I was a bit smarter in the way I trained myself. But as I said, because I was alone,
yeah.
I didn't have somebody, a mentor or a coach to really guide me, help me in guidance.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to guide myself.
Mm-hmm.
So if I would go back, I would definitely think of investing, of having a coach
mm-hmm.
With me, even if it does cost me some money
mm-hmm.
To do that. But I think it would have been a worthwhile investment.
And what is the one thing you're most proud of?
I'm proud of myself. I achieved well. I finished my university. I have my degree in economics. And then went into tennis, full-time tennis. I excelled in it. Maybe I did not reach the goal I wanted to be in the the best or the top five or the top 10, but I was not too far away from that.
You weren't too far from the top 10.
I was not too far, but I would have liked to be in the top 10. And I think I had the potential and I had the means to do it, but did not.
Well, I think you're still such an inspiration to me and our family.
Thank you
for being a part of our podcast.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening, and don't forget to subscribe, give us a review, shoot me a text, or direct message us on Instagram at Radical Contemporary, where we'd love to hear your feedback and the topics you'd like to listen to. Also, you can check out our website, www.radicalcontemporary.com, where all of our content is available. Finally, we'll be hosting a new guest every week, so stay tuned.